He played the piano, could read and write music, and took part in a weekly singing group. He was also able to recite, as Warren et al. Noted. He was able to read a passage chosen at random from the Torah, using the heightened intonation, distinct from both singing and ordinary reading, reserved for reading aloud. Many aphasic patients can get not only the words of songs, but can learn to repeat sequences or series, days of the week, months of the year, numerals, etc. They may be able to do this as a series, but not to disembed a particular item from the series. So, one of my patients, for instance, can recite all the months of the year in order. January, February, March, April, May. He knows what the current month is. But when I ask him, he cannot respond simply, April. Indeed, aphasics may be able to reproduce much more elaborate, familiar sequences, a prayer, or lines from Shakespeare, or an entire poem, but only as automated sequences. Such sequences unfold, once they are started, in much the same way as music does. Hewlings Jackson long ago distinguished propositional speech from what he called variously emotional, ejaculate, or automatic speech, stressing that the latter could be preserved in aphasia, sometimes to a startling extent, even when the former was grossly impaired. Cursing is often cited as a dramatic form of automatic speech, but singing familiar lyrics can be seen as equally automatic. A person with aphasia may be able to sing or curse or recite a poem, but not to utter a propositional phrase. The question of whether singing has any use in the recovery of speech, then, can be formulated another way. Can language embedded in unconscious automatism be released for conscious propositional use? During the Second World War, A.R. Luria began to investigate the neural basis of speech and language, of different forms of aphasia, and of methods for restoring speech. His work was published in Russian in a massive monograph, Traumatic Aphasia, in 1947, and in a small, startling book, Restoration of Function After Brain Injury, in 1948, though neither was translated or known in the West until several decades later. Given an acute injury to the brain, such as he saw in the stroke patients or injured soldiers he studied, Luria emphasized there would always be two levels of disturbance. First, there was a core of tissue destruction, which was irreversible, and second, a larger surrounding area or penumbra of depressed or inhibited function, which under certain conditions he felt might be reversible. When one first meets a patient immediately after a stroke or head injury, one sees only the total effects of injury, paralysis, aphasia, or other disabilities. It is difficult to distinguish disabilities produced by anatomical damage from those produced by inhibition of the surrounding neural tissue. Time will show the difference in most patients, for inhibition tends to lift spontaneously, usually in a matter of weeks. But in some patients, for reasons that are still unclear, it does not. At this point, if not before, it is crucial to start therapy, to promote what Luria called de-inhibition. Speech therapy may lead to de-inhibition, but it may sometimes fail. If it fails, one may wrongly assume that the patient's aphasia is due to permanent anatomical damage and is thus irreversible. But music therapy for some patients can succeed where conventional speech therapy has failed, as in the case of Samuel S. It may be that cortical areas previously inhibited but not destroyed can be de-inhibited, kick-started into action, by re-experiencing language, even if it is of a wholly automatic sort, language embedded in music. A very crucial aspect of speech or music therapy for the aphasic patient is the relationship between therapist and patient. Luria emphasized that the origin of speech was social, no less than neurological. It required the interaction of mother and child. It is likely that the same is true of song, and in this sense, music therapy for patients with aphasia is profoundly different from music therapy for a movement disorder like Parkinsonism. In Parkinsonism, It is the motor system which is being activated almost automatically by music, and a tape or CD in this limited sense can do as much as a therapist. But with speech disorders like aphasia, the therapist and her relationship with the patient, a relationship which involves not only musical and vocal interaction, but physical contact, gesture, imitation of movement, and prosody, is an essential part of the therapy. This intimate working together, this working in tandem, depends on mirror neurons throughout the brain, which enable the patient not only to imitate, but to incorporate the actions or abilities of others, as Rizzoletti et al. Have explored. The therapist not only provides support and an encouraging presence, but literally leads the patient into more and more complex forms of speech. With Samuel S., this involved drawing language out until he could sing all the words of Old Man River, then leading him on to sing a whole range of old songs, then, by the right sort of questions, drawing him into short, responsive phrases. Whether there is a chance of going beyond this, of restoring fluent narrative or propositional speech to patients with long-standing aphasia, remains an open question. Saying, "had a great time," or "saw the kids," may be as far as Samuel S. can go. It might be said that such verbal responses are modest, limited, and formulaic, but they do represent a radical advance from purely automatic speech, and they can have an enormous effect on the daily reality of an aphasic person's life, allowing a formerly mute and isolated person to re-enter a verbal world, a world he had seemingly lost forever. In 1973, Martin Albert and his colleagues in Boston described a form of music therapy they called melodic intonation therapy. Patients were taught to sing or intone short phrases. For example, "How are you today?" Then the musical elements of this were removed slowly until, in some cases, the patient regained the power to speak a little without the aid of intonation. One 67-year-old man, aphasic for 18 months, he could only produce meaningless grunts and had received 3 months of speech therapy without effect, started to produce words 2 days after beginning melodic intonation therapy. In 2 weeks, he had an effective vocabulary of 100 words, and at 6 weeks, he could carry on short, meaningful conversations. What is happening in the brain when melodic intonation or any type of music therapy works? Albert et al. Originally thought that it served to activate areas in the right hemisphere, areas homologous to Broca's area. Albert's close colleague, Norman Geschwind, had been fascinated by the way in which children could recover speech and language even after the removal of the entire left hemisphere of the brain. This was sometimes done in children with uncontrollable seizures. Such a recovery or reacquisition of language suggested to Geschwind that though linguistic ability was generally associated with the left hemisphere, the right hemisphere also had linguistic potential and could take over language functions almost completely, at least in children. Albert and his colleagues thus felt, without clear evidence, that this might be the case, at least to some degree, even in aphasic adults, and that melodic intonation therapy, calling as it did upon right hemisphere musical skills, could help to develop this potential. Detailed imaging of patients undergoing melodic intonation therapy was not possible during the 1970s, and a 1996 PET scan study by Pascal Bellin et al. Seemed to show that there was no activation in the right hemisphere of such patients. They reported, moreover, that there was not only an inhibition of Broca's area in aphasic patients, but hyperactivity of a homologous area in the right hemisphere. We may call it, for convenience, the right Broca's area. This sustained hyperactivity on the right side exerts an active inhibiting action on the good Broca's area, which in its weakened state is powerless to resist. The challenge, then, is not only to stimulate the normal, left Broca's area, but to find a way to damp down the right Broca's area with its malignant hyperactivity. Singing and melodic intonation seem to do exactly this. By engaging the right hemisphere circuits in normal activity, they disengage them from pathological activity. This process has a certain self-sustaining momentum of its own, for as the left Broca's area is released from inhibition, it can exert a suppressant action on the right Broca's area. A vicious circle, in short, is replaced by a therapeutic one. There is some preliminary evidence that the same effect may be accomplished by using repetitive bursts of transcranial magnetic stimulation applied to the right Broca's area to suppress its hyperactivity. Paula Martin and her colleagues have recently tried this technique in 4 patients who have been intractably aphasic for more than 5 years. Though they need confirmation, Martin et al.'s results are promising and may lead, they propose, to a novel complementary treatment for aphasia. For various reasons, little research attention was paid during the 1980s and 1990s to melodic intonation therapy for people with severe, non-fluent Broca's aphasia, or to the mechanisms by which it might work. Nonetheless, music therapists continue to observe that, in many cases, such therapy could allow very significant improvement. Recent work by Gottfried Schlaug and his colleagues carefully documents the brain activity of 8 patients undergoing melodic intonation therapy. This involves 75 sessions of intensive therapy. All of these patients, Schlaug et al. Report, showed significant changes in speech output measures and in a right hemispheric frontotemporal network while repeating simple words, phrases, in the MRI scanner. Schlaug showed me a number of videos of such patients, and the change in their ability to speak was indeed striking. Initially, many were incapable even of responding clearly to the question, "What is your address?" Following melodic intonation therapy, they were able to reply much more easily to such questions, even offering additional details beyond those asked for. They had clearly achieved at least a measure of propositional speech. These changes, both behavioral and anatomical, were retained even several months after the course of treatment had ended. As Schlaug points out, the neural processes that underlie post-stroke language recovery remain largely unknown and thus have not been specifically targeted by most aphasia therapies. But melodic intonation therapy, at least, has been shown to be ideally suited for facilitating language recovery in non-fluent aphasic patients, particularly in those with large left hemisphere lesions, for whom the only route to recovery may be the engagement of right hemispheric language regions. We have become accustomed, in the last 20 years or so, to dramatic revelations of cortical plasticity. Auditory cortex, it has been shown, can be reallocated for visual processing in congenitally deaf people, and the visual cortex in blind people may be recruited for auditory and tactile functions. But perhaps even more remarkable is the notion that the right hemisphere, which in normal circumstances has only the most rudimentary linguistic capacities, can be turned into a reasonably efficient linguistic organ with less than 3 months of training, and that music is the key to this transformation. Chapter 17. Accidental Davening. Dyskinesia and Cantillation. Solomon R. was an intelligent middle-aged man with a dyskinesia, an unusual movement disorder which, in him, took the form of rhythmic pulsions of various sorts, forcible expulsions of breath, accompanied by loud phonations, and a synchronous contraction of abdominal and trunk muscles, causing his body to bow or rock with each expiration. Over the weeks that I saw him, there was a strange elaboration of this picture. The expiratory phonatory beat began to acquire a sort of melody, a repetitive sing-song to accompany it, and to this, in turn, was added a half-articulate murmuring quality, like the prosody of a soft, unintelligible language. With this, and his now increasing bowing movement, Mr. R. seemed to be cantillating, praying, davening, as such murmuring, rhythmically motoric prayer, is called by religious Jews. Indeed, a couple of weeks later, I was able to catch a number of Hebrew words, which seemed to confirm my impression. But when I asked Mr. R., he told me that though they were indeed Hebrew words, they made no sense. They were plucked out of the air, he said, as if to fill the prosodic and melodic demand of his dyskinesia. Random though the words were, this strange activity gave Mr. R. a deep satisfaction and allowed him to feel he was doing something, and not just the victim of a physical automatism. Wanting to document this extraordinary scene, I went one day to the hospital with my tape recorder. As soon as I entered, I could hear Mr. R. down the hall. Or so I thought, but when I entered the room, I found a Sabbath service in progress. The cantillation was coming not from my patient, but from the davening rabbi himself. With the rabbi, presumably, the rhythmic emphases of prayer had led to a sympathetic rhythmic movement of the body, but with Mr. R., it had happened the other way round. Not originally a man attracted to cantillation or prayer, he had now been drawn to this through the physiological accident of dyskinesia. Chapter 18. Come Together, Music and Tourette's Syndrome. John S., a young man with Tourette's syndrome, recently wrote to me, describing the effect of music on his tics. Music is a huge part of my life. It can be both a blessing and a curse when it comes to ticking. It can send me into a state where I forget all about Tourette's, or it can bring on a surge of tics that is difficult to control or bear. He added that his tics were especially brought on by certain kinds of music heavy with rhythm, and that their frequency and intensity might be determined by music, accelerating or slowing along with the music's tempo. Reactions like this are very similar to those of Parkinsonian patients, who may find themselves forgetting their Parkinsonism, enjoying a delicious motor freedom with some kinds of music, but being driven or entrained by others. But while Tourette's may be considered, like Parkinsonism, a movement disorder, albeit of an explosive rather than an obstructive kind, it is much more. It has a mind of its own. Tourette's is impulsive, productive, where Parkinsonism is not. Sometimes this productivity is more or less confined to the production of simple tics or repetitive fixed movements, and this seems to be the case with John S. But for some people, it may assume an elaborate, phantasmagoric form, remarkable for its mimicry, antics, playfulness, inventions, and unexpected and sometimes surreal associations. People with this rarer, phantasmagoric form of Tourette's may show much more complex reactions to music. One such man, Sidney A., could have very extravagant reactions to music, as he did one day to a piece of Western music on the radio. He lurched, jerked, lunged, yelped, made faces, and gesticulated exuberantly, and above all, he mimed and mimicked. The music seemed to trigger a cascade of wild, mimetic representations of the tone, the tenor, the landscape of the music, and all the images and emotional reactions these provoked in him as he listened. This was not just an exacerbation of ticking, but an extraordinary Touretic representation of the music, a very personal expression of his sensibility and imagination, though dominated by Touretic exaggeration, parody, and impulsiveness. I was reminded of a description by Henri Meige and E. Feindel in their 1902 book, Tics and Their Treatment, of a man with Tourette's who showed, on occasion, a veritable debauch of absurd gesticulations, a wild, muscular carnival. I thought of Sidney, sometimes, as a mimetic virtuoso, but this was not a mimesis under his control, and for all its brilliance, it always had a certain flavour of the convulsive and the excessive. And yet, on another occasion, when Sidney took up his guitar and sang an old ballad, there was no ticking at all, but a total immersion in or identification with the song and its mood. Extraordinary creative interactions can occur when someone with Tourette's performs as a musician. Ray G. was a man strongly drawn to jazz, who played drums in a band on the weekends. He was noted for his sudden and wild solos, which would often arise from a convulsive drum-hitting tick, but the tick could initiate a cascade of percussive speed and invention and elaboration. Ray is more fully described in Witty Ticky Ray, a chapter in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Jazz, or rock, with its heavy beat and its freedom to improvise, may be especially attractive to a musical person with Tourette's, and I have known a number of brilliant Tourettic musicians who are jazz artists, though I also know other musicians with Tourette's who are more drawn to the structure and rigor of classical music. David Aldridge, a professional jazz drummer, explored these themes in a memoir entitled Rhythm Man. I've been banging on car dashboards since I was 6 years old, following and flowing with the rhythm until it poured out of my ears. Rhythm and Tourette syndrome have been intertwined from the first day I found that drumming on a table could mask my jerky hand, leg, and neck movements. This newly found masking actually harnessed my unbounded energy, directing it into an orderly flow. This permission to explode let me tap into vast reservoirs of sounds and physical sensations, and I realized that my destiny lay clearly before me. I was to become a rhythm man. Aldridge relied on music frequently, both to mask his tics and to channel their explosive energy. I would learn to harness the enormous energy of Tourette syndrome and control it like a high-pressure fire hose. Harnessing his Tourette's and expressing himself in creative, unpredictable musical improvisations seemed to be deeply intertwined. The urge to play and the desire to release the endless tension of Tourette syndrome fed on each other like fuel on fire. For Aldridge, and perhaps for many with Tourette's, music was inseparably linked to movement and to sensation of all sorts. The attractions, the joys, and the therapeutic powers of drumming and drum circles are widely known in the Tourette's community. In New York recently, I took part in a drum circle organized by Matt Giordano, a gifted drummer with severe Tourette's. When he is not focused or engaged, Matt is in constant Tourette-ic motion, and indeed, everyone in the room that day seemed to be ticking, ticking in their own time. I could see eruptions of ticks, contagions of ticks, rippling around the 30-odd Tourettes there. But once the drum circle started, with Matt leading them, all the ticking disappeared within seconds. Suddenly there was synchronization, and they came together as a group, performing in the moment with the rhythm, as Matt puts it. Their Tourette-ic energy, motor exuberance, playfulness, and inventiveness all drawn upon creatively and given expression in the music. Music here had a double power. First, to reconfigure brain activity and bring calm and focus to people who were sometimes distracted or preoccupied by incessant tics and impulses. And second, to promote a musical and social bonding with others, so that what began as a miscellany of isolated, often distressed, or self-conscious individuals almost instantly became a cohesive group with a single aim, a veritable drum orchestra under Matt's baton. Nick Van Bloss, a young English musician, has Tourette's of considerable severity. He reckons that he has nearly 40,000 tics a day, including his obsessions, imitations, counting compulsions, compulsive touchings, and so on. But when he plays the piano, he shows scarcely a hint of this. I asked him to play some Bach for me. Bach is his favorite composer, and Glenn Gould is his hero, and he did so without interruption. The only tics he displayed, a mild facial grimacing, were far less disturbing, I thought, than Gould's famous humming. Van Bloss developed his first, rather explosive symptoms when he was 7, attracting savage ridicule and bullying from his schoolmates. There was no intermission in his ticking until his family got a piano, and this was to transform his life. "Suddenly, I had a piano," he writes in his memoir, Busybody, "and, as if handed to me on a plate, I found my love. When I played, my tics almost seemed to disappear. It was like a miracle. I would tick gyrate and verbally explode all day at school, get home exhausted from it all and run to the piano and play for as long as I could, not only because I loved the sounds I was making, but primarily because when I played, I didn't tick. I got time off from the ticky normality that had become me. When I discussed this with Van Bloss, he spoke of it partly in terms of energy. It was not, he felt, that his Tourette's had disappeared, but that it was now being harnessed and focused, and specifically, that his compulsions to touch could now be consummated by touching the keys of the piano. I was simultaneously feeding and fueling my Tourette's by giving it a thing it so craved. Touch, he writes. The piano appealed to my fingers, provided touch heaven for me. 88 keys, all sitting and waiting for my needy little fingers. Van Bloss feels that his repertoire of tics was fully developed by the age of 16 and has changed little in the years since, but he is now far more accepting of them, for he recognizes that his Tourette's, in a paradoxical way, plays an essential role in his piano playing. I found it especially fascinating to listen to a conversation between Nick Van Bloss and Tobias Picker, the distinguished composer, who also has Tourette's, to listen to them compare notes on the role that Tourette's has played in their music-making. Picker also has many tics, but when he is composing or playing the piano or conducting, his tics disappear. I have watched him as he sits almost motionless for hours, orchestrating one of his etudes for piano at his computer. The tics may have vanished, but this does not mean that the Tourette's itself has gone. Picker feels, on the contrary, that his Tourette's enters into his creative imagination, contributing to his music, but also being shaped and modulated by it. I live my life controlled by Tourette's, he said to me, but I use music to control it. I have harnessed its energy. I play with it, manipulate it, trick it, mimic it, taunt it, explore it, exploit it in every possible way. His newest piano concerto, in some sections, is full of turbulent, agitated whirls and twirls. But Picker writes in every mode, the dreamy and tranquil no less than the violent and stormy, and moves from one mood to another with consummate ease. Tourette's brings out in stark form questions of will and determination. Who orders what? Who pushes whom around? To what extent are people with Tourette's controlled by a sovereign I, a complex self-aware intentional self, or by impulses and feelings at lower levels in the brain-mind? Similar questions are brought up by musical hallucinations and brainworms and varied forms of quasi-automatic echoing and imitation. Normally, we are not aware of what goes on in our brains, of the innumerable agencies and forces inside us that lie outside or below the level of conscious experience, and perhaps this is just as well. Life becomes more complicated, sometimes unbearably so, for people with eruptive tics or obsessions or hallucinations, forced into daily incessant contact with rebellious and autonomous mechanisms in their own brains. They face a special challenge, but they may also, if the tics or hallucinations are not too overwhelming, achieve a sort of self-knowledge or reconciliation that may significantly enrich them in their strange fight, the double lives they lead. Chapter 19. Keeping Time, Rhythm and Movement. 1974 was an eventful year for me in several respects, for it was a year in which I had musical hallucinations twice, attacks of amusia twice, and the complex musicomotor events I would later describe in A Leg to Stand On. I had had a bad climbing accident on a mountain in Norway, tearing off the quadriceps tendon of my left leg, as well as doing some nerve damage to it. The leg was useless, and I had to find a way to get down the mountain before nightfall. I soon discovered that the best strategy was to row myself down, somewhat as paraplegics do in their wheelchairs. At first I found this difficult and awkward, but soon I fell into a rhythm, accompanied by a sort of marching or rowing song, sometimes the vulgar boatmen's song, with a strong heave on each beat. Before this, I had muscled myself along. Now, with the beat, I was musicked along. Without this synchronization of music and movement, the auditory with the motor, I could never have made my way down the mountain. And somehow, with this internal rhythm and music, it felt much less like a grim, anxious struggle. I was rescued halfway down the mountain and taken to a hospital, where my leg was examined, x-rayed, and put into a cast, and then I was flown to England, where, 48 hours after the injury, I had surgery to repair the tendon. Nerve and other tissue damage had to await a natural healing, of course, and there was a 14-day period, therefore, in which I could not use the leg. Indeed, it seemed to be both numb and paralyzed, and not really even a part of me. On the 15th day, when it was judged safe for me to put weight on the leg, I found that I had, strangely, forgotten how to walk. There was only a sort of pseudo-walking, conscious, cautious, unreal, step by step. I would make steps that were too large or too small, and on a couple of occasions managed to cross the left leg in front of the right one, almost tripping on it. The natural, unthinking spontaneity, the automaticity of walking, completely evaded me until again, suddenly, music came to my aid. I had been given a cassette of Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto in E minor. This was the only music I had, and I had been playing it for 2 weeks almost non-stop. Now, suddenly, as I was standing, the concerto started to play itself with intense vividness in my mind. In this moment, the natural rhythm and melody of walking came back to me, and along with this, the feeling of my leg as alive, as part of me once again. I suddenly remembered how to walk. The neural systems underlying the newly rediscovered skill of walking were still fragile and easily exhausted, and after half a minute or so of fluent walking, the inner music, the vividly imagined violin concerto, stopped suddenly, as if the needle had been lifted from a record. In that instant, walking stopped too. Then, after I had rested for a while, the music and motion came back to me, again in tandem. After my accident, I wondered if this sort of experience occurred with others, and barely a month had gone by when I saw a patient at a nursing home, an old lady with an apparently paralyzed and useless left leg. She had suffered a complex hip fracture, followed by surgery and many weeks of immobility in a cast. Surgery had been successful, but her leg remained strangely inert and useless. Though there was no clear anatomical or neurological reason for this, she told me she could not imagine how to move the leg. Had the leg ever been able to move since the injury? I asked her. She thought for a moment and said yes, it had, once. It had kept time at a Christmas concert, by itself, when an Irish jig was being played. This was enough. It indicated that whatever was going on, or not going on, in her nervous system, music could act as an activator, a de-inhibitor. We bombarded her with dance tunes, especially Irish jigs, and saw for ourselves how her leg responded. It took several months, for the leg had become very atrophied. Nevertheless, with music, she was not only able to delight in her own quasi-automatic motor responses, which soon included walking, but to extract from them an ability to make whatever discrete, voluntary movements she desired. She had reclaimed her leg and her sensory motor system in full. Hippocrates, more than 2,000 years ago, wrote of people who fell and broke their hips, which in those pre-surgical days demanded months of bandaging and immobility to let the bones knit. In such cases, he wrote, the imagination is subdued, and the patient cannot remember how to stand or walk. With the advent of functional brain imaging, the neural basis of such subduing has been clarified. There may be inhibition or deactivation not only peripherally, in the nerve elements of the damaged tendons and muscles, and perhaps in the spinal cord, but also centrally, in the body image, the mapping or representation of the body in the brain. A.R. Luria, in a letter to me, once referred to this as the central resonances of a peripheral injury. The affected limb may lose its place in the body image, while the rest of the body's representation then expands to fill the vacancy. If this happens, the limb is not only rendered functionless, it no longer seems to belong to one at all. Moving such a limb feels like moving an inanimate object. Another system must be brought in, and it is clear that music, above all else, can kickstart a damaged or inhibited motor system into action again. Whether it was the singing of a simple rowing song on the mountain, or the vivid imagining of the Mendelssohn violin concerto when I stood up in the hospital, the rhythm or beat of the music was crucial for me, as it was for my patient with the fractured hip. Was it just the rhythm or beat of the music, or was the melody with its movement, its momentum, also important? Beyond the repetitive motions of walking and dancing, music may allow an ability to organize, to follow intricate sequences, or to hold great volumes of information in mind. This is the narrative or mnemonic power of music. It was very clear with my patient, Dr. P., who had lost the ability to recognize or identify even common objects, though he could see perfectly well. He may have suffered from an early and primarily visual form of Alzheimer's. He was unable to recognize a glove or a flower when I handed it to him, and he once mistook his own wife for a hat. His condition was almost totally disabling, but he discovered that he could perform the needs and tasks of the day if they were organized in song. His wife explained to me, "I put all his usual clothes out in all the usual places, and he dresses without difficulty, singing to himself. He does everything singing to himself, but if he is interrupted and loses the thread, he comes to a complete stop, doesn't know his clothes or his own body. He sings all the time, eating songs, dressing songs, bathing songs, everything. He can't do anything unless he makes it a song." Patients with frontal lobe damage may also lose the ability to carry out a complex chain of actions, to dress, for example. Here, music can be very useful as a mnemonic or a narrative, in effect, a series of commands or promptings in the form of rhyme or a song, as in the childhood song, This Old Man. It is similar with some autistic people and with severely retarded people, who may be unable to perform fairly simple sequences, involving perhaps four or five movements or procedures, but who can often do these tasks perfectly well if they set them to music. Music has the power to embed sequences, and to do this when other forms of organization, including verbal forms, fail. Every culture has songs and rhymes to help children learn the alphabet, numbers, and other lists. Even as adults, we are limited in our ability to memorize series or to hold them in mind unless we use mnemonic devices or patterns, and the most powerful of these devices are rhyme, meter, and song. We may have to sing the ABC song internally to remember the alphabet, or imagine Tom Lehrer's song to remember all the chemical elements. For someone who is gifted musically, a huge amount of information can be retained in this way, consciously or unconsciously. The composer Ernst Toch, his grandson Lawrence Wechsler tells me, could readily hold in his mind a very long string of numbers after a single hearing, and he did this by converting the string of numbers into a tune, a melody he shaped corresponding to the numbers. A neurobiology professor recounted to me the story of an extraordinary student, Jay, whose answers on one exam sounded suspiciously familiar. The professor wrote, "A few sentences later, I thought, no wonder I like her answers. She's quoting my lectures word for word." There was also a question on the exam that she answered with a direct quote from the textbook. The next day, I called Jay into my office to have a talk with her about cheating and plagiarism. But something did not add up. Jay did not seem like a cheater. She seemed totally lacking in guile. So as she walked into my office, what came into my head and out of my mouth was the question, "Jay, do you have a photographic memory?" She answered very excitedly, "Yes, sort of like that. I can remember anything as long as I put it to music." She then sang back to me from memory whole portions of my lectures, and very prettily too. I was flabbergasted. While this student is, like Toch, extraordinarily gifted, all of us use the power of music in this way, and setting words to music, especially in pre-literate cultures, has played a huge role in relation to the oral traditions of poetry, storytelling, liturgy, and prayer. Entire books can be held in memory. The Iliad and the Odyssey, famously, could be recited at length because, like ballads, they had rhythm and rhyme. How much such recitation depends on musical rhythm and how much purely on linguistic rhyming is difficult to tell, but these are surely related. Both rhyme and rhythm derive from the Greek, carrying the conjoined meanings of measure, motion, and stream. An articulate stream, a melody or prosody, is necessary to carry one along, and this is something that unites language and music and may underlie their perhaps common origins. The powers of reproduction and recitation may be achieved with very little idea of meaning. One has to wonder how much Martin, my retarded savant patient, understood of the 2,000 cantatas and operas he knew by heart, or how much Gloria Lenhoff, a woman with Williams syndrome and an IQ under 60, actually comprehends the thousands of arias in 35 languages which she can sing from memory. The embedding of words, skills, or sequences in melody and meter is uniquely human. The usefulness of such an ability to recall large amounts of information, especially in a pre-literate culture, is surely one reason why musical abilities have flourished in our species. The relationship between motor and auditory systems has been investigated by asking people to tap to a beat, or, where commands cannot be given verbally, as with infants or animals, by observing whether there is any spontaneous synchronization of movement with an external musical beat. Ani Patel at the Neurosciences Institute has recently pointed out that in every culture there is some form of music with a regular beat, a periodic pulse that affords temporal coordination between performers and elicits synchronized motor response from listeners. This linking of auditory and motor systems seems universal in humans and shows itself spontaneously early in life. But as Patel wrote in his 2006 paper, there is not a single report of an animal being trained to tap, peck, or move in synchrony with an auditory beat. No doubt many pet lovers will dispute this notion, and indeed many animals, from the Lipizzaner horses of the Spanish Riding School of Vienna to performing circus animals, appear to dance to music. It is not clear whether they are doing so, or are responding to subtle visual or tactile cues from the humans around them. In Thailand, elephants have been trained to strike percussion instruments and play on their own. Intrigued by accounts of the Thai elephant orchestra, Patel and Everson made careful measurements and video recordings of the elephant's performances. They found, as they reported in a 2006 paper, that an elephant could play a percussion instrument, a large drum, with a highly stable tempo. Indeed, a tempo more stable than most humans could achieve. But the other elephants in the orchestra struck their instruments, cymbals, gongs, etc., in seeming disregard of each other, without any hint of synchronization to the auditory beat of the drum elephant. The rather mechanical term entrainment is sometimes used in regard to the human tendency to keep time, to make motor responses to rhythm. But research has shown that so-called responses to rhythm actually precede the external beat. We anticipate the beat, we get rhythmic patterns as soon as we hear them, and we establish internal models or templates of them. These internal templates are astonishingly precise and stable. As Daniel Levitin and Perry Cook have shown, humans have very accurate memories for tempo and rhythm. Galileo famously exemplified this in his experiments timing the descent of objects as they rolled down inclined planes. Having no accurate watches or clocks to go by, he timed each trial by humming tunes to himself, and this allowed him to get results with an accuracy far beyond that of the timepieces of his era. Chen, Zatori, and Penhune in Montreal have studied the ability of human beings to keep time, to follow a beat, and they have used functional brain imaging to visualize how this is reflected in the brain. Not surprisingly, they found activation of the motor cortex and of subcortical systems in the basal ganglia and cerebellum when subjects tapped or made other movements in response to music. What is more remarkable is their finding that listening to music or imagining it, even without any overt movement or keeping time, activates motor cortex and subcortical motor systems too. Thus, the imagination of music, of rhythm, may be as potent, neurally, as actually listening to it. Keeping time, physically and mentally, depends, as Chen and her colleagues have found, on interactions between the auditory and the dorsal premotor cortex, and it is only in the human brain that a functional connection between these two cortical areas exists. Crucially, these sensory and motor activations are precisely integrated with each other. Rhythm, in this sense, the integration of sound and movement, can play a great role in coordinating and invigorating basic locomotor movement. I found this when I was rowing myself down the mountain to the Volga Boatmen song, and when the Mendelssohn enabled me to walk again. Musical rhythm can be valuable, similarly, to athletes, as the physician, Melanie Kinnison, a competitive cyclist and triathlete, observed to me. I have been a competitive cyclist for a number of years, and have always been interested in the individual time trial, an event that pits the rider against the clock only. The effort required to excel at this event is painful. I often listen to music while I am training, and noticed fairly early that some pieces of music were particularly uplifting and inspired a high level of effort. One day in the early stages of an important time trial event, a few bars of the overture to Orpheus in the Underworld by Offenbach started playing in my head. This was wonderful. It stimulated my performance, settled my cadence at just the right tempo, and synchronized my physical efforts with my breathing. Time collapsed. I was truly in the zone, and for the first time in my life, I was sorry to see the finish line. My time was a personal best. Now all of Kinnison's competitive cycling is accompanied by bracing musical imagery, usually from operatic overtures. Many athletes have had similar experiences. I have found it similar with swimming. In swimming freestyle, one usually kicks in groups of three, with a strong kick to every arm stroke, followed by two softer kicks. Sometimes I count these to myself as I swim. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But then this conscious counting gives way to music with a similar beat. On long, leisurely swims, Strauss waltzes tend to play in my mind, synchronizing all my movements, providing an automatism and accuracy beyond anything I can achieve with conscious counting. Leibniz said of music that it is counting, but counting unconsciously, and this is precisely what swimming to Strauss is all about. The fact that rhythm, in this special sense of combining movement and sound, appears spontaneously in human children, but not in any other primate, forces one to reflect on its phylogenetic origins. It has often been suggested that music did not evolve on its own, but emerged as a byproduct of other capacities with more obvious adaptive significance, such as speech. Did speech, in fact, precede music, as Steven Pinker suggests? Did song precede speech, as Darwin thought? Or did both develop simultaneously, as Mithun proposes? How can this dispute be resolved? Patel asks in his 2006 paper. One approach is to determine whether there are fundamental aspects aspects of music cognition which cannot be explained as byproducts or secondary uses of more clearly adaptive abilities. Musical rhythm, with its regular pulse, he points out, is very unlike the irregular stressed syllables of speech. The perception and synchronization of beat, Patel feels, is an aspect of rhythm that appears to be unique to music and cannot be explained as a byproduct of linguistic rhythm. It seems probable, he concludes, that musical rhythm evolved independently of speech. There is certainly a universal and unconscious propensity to impose a rhythm, even when one hears a series of identical sounds at constant intervals. John Everson, a neuroscientist and an avid drummer, has pointed this out. We tend to hear the sound of a digital clock, for example, as tick-tock, tick-tock, even though it is actually tick, 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 tick. Anyone who has been subjected to the monotonous volleys of noise from the oscillating magnetic fields that bombard one during an MRI has probably had a similar experience. Sometimes the deafening ticks of the machine seem to organize themselves in a waltz-like rhythm of threes, sometimes in groups of four or five. It is as if the brain has to impose a pattern of its own, even if there is no objective pattern present. This can be true not only with patterns in time, but with tonal patterns too. We tend to add a sort of melody to the sound of a train. There is a wonderful example of this, raised to the level of art, in Arthur Honegger's Pacific 231, or to hear melodies in other mechanical noises. One friend of mine feels that the hum of her refrigerator has a Haydnish quality. And for some people, with musical hallucinations, these may first appear as an elaboration of a mechanical noise, as with Dwight Mamlock and Michael Sundu. Leo Rangel, another man with musical hallucinations, commented on how elementary rhythmic sounds, for him, became songs or jingles. And for Solomon R., in Chapter 17, rhythmic body movements gave rise to a sing-song cantillation, their minds giving meaning to what would otherwise be a meaningless sound or movement. Anthony Storr, in his excellent book Music and the Mind, stresses that in all societies, a primary function of music is collective and communal, to bring and bind people together. People sing together and dance together in every culture, and one can imagine them having done so around the first fires, 100,000 years ago. This primal role of music is to some extent lost today, when we have a special class of composers and performers, with the rest of us often reduced to passive listening. We have to go to a concert, or a church, or a musical festival, to re-experience music as a social activity, to recapture the collective excitement and bonding of music. In such a situation, music is a communal experience, and there seems to be, in some sense, an actual binding or marriage of nervous systems, a neurogamy, to use a word the early mesmerists favored. The binding is accomplished by rhythm, not only heard but internalized, identically, in all who are present. Rhythm turns listeners into participants, makes listening active and motoric, and synchronizes the brains and minds, and, since emotion is always intertwined with music, the hearts of all who participate. It is very difficult to remain detached, to resist being drawn into the rhythm of chanting or dancing. I observed this when I took my patient, Greg F., to a Grateful Dead concert at Madison Square Garden in 1991. Greg's story is related in The Last Hippie, in An Anthropologist on Mars. The music, the rhythm, got everyone within seconds. I saw the whole vast arena in motion with the music, 18,000 people dancing, transported, every nervous system there synchronized to the music. Greg had had a massive tumor which had wiped out his memory and much of his spontaneity. He had been amnesic and inert, barely responsive except to music for many years. But he was taken over and animated by the thumping, pounding excitement of the crowd around him, the rhythmic clapping and chanting, and soon he, too, began shouting the name of one of his favorite songs, Tobacco Road, Tobacco Road. I say I observed all this, but I found myself unable to remain a detached observer. I realized that I, too, was moving, stamping, clapping with the music, and soon lost all my usual diffidence and inhibition and joined the crowd in communal dancing. Augustine, in his Confessions, described how, on one occasion, he went to a gladiatorial show with an aloof young man who professed disgust and contempt at the scenes before him. But when the crowd grew excited and began a rhythmic roaring and stamping, the young man could resist no longer, and joined in as orgiastically as everyone else. I have had similar experiences in religious contexts, even though I am largely lacking in religious faith or feeling. When I was a boy, I loved Simchas Torah, the rejoicing of the law, which was celebrated, even in our normally sober Orthodox congregation, with ecstatic chanting and dancing round and round the synagogue. While in many cases religious practice now tends to be somewhat decorous and detached, there is evidence that religious practices began with communal chanting and dancing, often of an ecstatic kind, and not infrequently, culminating in states of trance. The almost irresistible power of rhythm is evident in many other contexts. In marching, it serves both to entrain and coordinate movement, and to whip up a collective and perhaps martial excitement. We see this not only with military music and war drums, but also with the slow, solemn rhythm of a funeral march. We see it with work songs of every sort, rhythmic songs that probably arose with the beginnings of agriculture, when tilling the soil, hoeing, and threshing all required the combined and synchronized efforts of a group of people. Rhythm and its entrainment of movement, and often emotion, its power to move people, in both senses of the word, may well have had a crucial cultural and economic function in human evolution, bringing people together, producing a sense of collectivity and community. This, indeed, is central to the vision of cultural evolution presented by Merlin Donald in his astonishing 1991 book, Origins of the Modern Mind, and in many subsequent papers. An essential feature of Donald's vision is his concept that human evolution moved from the episodic life of apes to a mimetic culture, and that this flourished and lasted for tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of years, before language and conceptual thinking evolved. Donald proposes that mimesis, the power to represent emotions, external events, or stories, using only gesture and posture, movement and sound, but not language, is still the bedrock of human culture today. He sees rhythm as having a unique role in relation to mimesis. Rhythm is an integrative mimetic skill, related to both vocal and visuomotor mimesis. Rhythmic ability is supramodal. That is, once a rhythm is established, it may be played out with any motor modality, including the hands, feet, mouth, or the whole body. It is apparently self-reinforcing, in the way that perceptual exploration and motor play are self-reinforcing. Rhythm is, in a sense, the quintessential mimetic skill. Rhythmic games are widespread among human children, and there are few, if any, human cultures that have not employed rhythm as an expressive device. Donald goes further, seeing rhythmic skill as a prerequisite not only for all music, but for all sorts of non-verbal activities, from the simple rhythmic patterns of agricultural life to the most complex social and ritual behaviors. Neuroscientists sometimes speak of the binding problem, the process by which different perceptions or aspects of perception are bound together and unified. What enables us, for example, to bind together the sight, sound, smell, and emotions aroused by the sight of a jaguar? Such binding in the nervous system is accomplished by rapid, synchronized firing of nerve cells in different parts of the brain. Just as rapid neuronal oscillations bind together different functional parts within the brain and nervous system, so rhythm binds together the individual nervous systems of a human community. Chapter 20. Kinetic Melody. Parkinson's Disease and Music Therapy. William Harvey, writing about animal movement in 1628, called it the silent music of the body. Similar metaphors are often used by neurologists who speak of normal movement as having a naturalness and fluency, a kinetic melody. This smooth, graceful flow of movement is compromised in Parkinsonism and some other disorders, and neurologists speak here of kinetic stutter. When we walk, our steps emerge in a rhythmical stream, a flow that is automatic and self-organizing. In Parkinsonism, this normal, happy automatism is gone. Though I was born into a musical household and music has been important to me personally from my earliest years, I did not really encounter music in a clinical context until 1966, when I started work at Beth Abraham Hospital,